Hi, my name is Matt. So here we are today. I get to tell my story, what happened, and how I got here in front of you. I want to start in the beginning, how I grew up. I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My childhood was, my parents were very loving and caring, and unfortunately, I believe because of alcoholism, the marriage didn't last after about 15 years. So there was a lot of us moving back and forth, as a young age and changing schools a lot, and a lot of distraction, chaos, things that we had talked about in some of the other talks. First, I want to thank the committee for putting this all together. I really love coming to this conference. I've been here once before. I think there's something to be said about the 12-step program. Whenever I get to come to a meeting when I'm traveling or being in a community, there's a warmness that comes or a safety I feel when I get to go attend a meeting while I'm on the road. And it's kind of funny because I can't really share that with most people. So it's great that I can say that to you and everybody understands what I'm talking about. And that's been a big part of my recovery. I do want to thank Sean for last night. I was really inspired by his talk and everything he had to say. The other piece about recovery is that I get a big piece out of going to AA meetings. They help me a lot of times. I feel like more than my own tribe because it makes more sense a lot of times. Some of the confusion's removed from me. So I'm really grateful that I got to hear Sean last night and I got to hear the AA speak this morning about their recovery and their strength and hope that they bring. I'm always getting something out of it. So growing up in an alcoholic home, there was a lot of confusion, a lot of fun, and a lot of things that we were lacking, a lot of things that we didn't get that parents who were struggling with diseases or mental health problems weren't able to give us. And you don't know that as a little guy. And I had I have two sisters and a brother, so there's four of us. And I don't know, I feel like everything was great. My mom was the alcoholic in my family, and my dad was the Al-Anon. And I always felt like, I was always starving to get their attention. I always had to do, because I had all these siblings, and they were also somewhat dysfunctional and doing the best they could to survive. But that's really confusing as a little kid. Like, I don't think that I was ever aware that there was a problem or that things were wrong or there was issues, even though there probably was a lot of things going on that I was, a lot of neglect, a lot of spending just times with our siblings, having to take care of myself at a young age. When my parents had gotten divorced, at 8, I was like my own guy. I could just get on my bicycle and ride anywhere. I could, I was free. I didn't have any parenting around me to say, where are you going or what are you doing? I liked that, to be honest with you. As an Al-Anon, as a kid, I hated dealing with authority. I hated dealing with somebody who was trying to tell me what to do or what the rules were. Because my mom was just always like, just have fun, don't worry about it. I was always free to just do whatever I wanted. And I enjoyed it, but unfortunately that led to, I think, me not being as functional in the school situation. And resenting my father, who was the Al-Anon, who was the controlling person, who was actually kind of steering the ship, who was able to try to give me, who I just felt was really strict and just was forceful and used fear to control us and tell us what to do. And he was always so a lot of fun too, and he was, always take us out and do things with the kids and entertain us and really enjoyed us. But at the same time, and I think the discovery of my dad being the Al-Anon in the family is a new thing in my recovery. But that kind of sets the stage, with the siblings and getting divorced and dealing with moving around a lot as a kid. My schoolwork really was not good. So every time we'd go to a different school, the records never came in time to figure out what class to put the kid in, if that makes any sense. So it was always very confusing. Wherever I go, they'd kind of just have to see what I was doing to figure out where I was supposed to be. And then I was dealing with the challenges of relationship with other kids and teachers, and it was just very confusing for me. It was confusing at home, and it was confusing at school. And so it made for a hard, I would say hard, but it made me to adapt with certain tools in a different way than I say maybe most kids had to, where they had regular stability. They had parents that were maybe listening to them or giving them their needs that they needed more. I felt like it was fine. So, but I made it, I did actually make it all the way to, I actually graduated from high school miraculously, in a good way, because I was able to get treated in fifth grade for learning disabilities. And so from then on, I was in fifth grade being sent to small schools and being, I was in these small classrooms away from everybody else. So at that time, I was starting to feel like there's something wrong. You know, there's something going on with me that I was not accepted, and I wasn't able to be in the regular classrooms because I wasn't successful with schoolwork. I felt like a failure there. So I was automatically, I would say, at fifth grade, just putting with the bad kids, right? And I did have behavior problems, and I did act out, and I did get suspended. And, it was just more headaches. And also at 8 years old, it was a big thing that I think it was interesting, as Sean talked about, it was that I was taken away from my mom and I was sent to my dad's house. And that was a horrific moment in my life. And I really remember that time. And I just felt so, my mom had met another guy and she wanted to be with that guy. And so we all the kids got sent to my dad's, and it was in another city. And I just felt betrayed. I remember looking at her at that little age, feeling totally betrayed by this woman that it was like the only thing that I felt the most to. I mean, I want to cry. I was born on her birthday. We were, I was really close to her. And so that kind of, you had to adapt at a young age and move on. And I do remember my life had changed dramatically. I started gaining a lot of weight. I started just finding other ways to adapt, I guess, and not knowing what was going on. But I did eventually get back to my mom's a couple years later, and they decided to split all the kids up. They split the two youngest ups with the two oldest, and they positioned us against the kids, all alcoholic type behavior. Where the youngest went with the mom and the two oldest that were difficult and always screaming at the mom said, I want to be with my dad. And so we kind of lost that unity of at least the siblings at the time. And what's sad is I feel like that unity's never come back. I'm close with my siblings now, but this disease does so much damage. So I made it back to my mom's, and I got to get through high school, and I graduated, and everything seemed just fine. I didn't go to college. I had no interest in school. I thought that was silly. But I did come out to California. I thought I would can't function in school. I was good with my hands. I was into building things. And I was able to, I always thought that I could be an actor. That was my thing. And I think growing up in the Midwest, I think the idea of being an actor was about the most ludicrous thing you could possibly tell somebody. They thought you having a dream or you inspiring to be something was really ludicrous. But for some reason, I think with the ailments and the struggles and me trying to adapt and find my way, I had, for some reason, my mom always said, kid, you could do whatever you want. Now, I think that's a really great thing to tell a child, instead of forcing the child to be what you want him to be, But the thing was, as an alcoholic woman telling their children this, I feel like it was like, but good luck. There was no like, oh, you want to leave? Like, good, like, you could do anything. But there was no real parenting. There was no, it was more of a friend relationship. She was really, I would say using and playing video games with my friends in high school. And she was like one of us. She really wasn't. So I lacked that whole piece of parenting, that big tool of the role of a parent, And But I still loved her. We never argued, and I was just accepting of the situation. And I think as an Al-Anon, I didn't have somebody who was trying to control me or tell me what to do. So it was a perfect dynamic of the Al-Anon, even in the parent role, is the Al-Anon, one being an Al-Anon, one being the addict, where we just enabled each other. You know, it was a huge piece. So even with the children, you know, it happens. And so as I came out to California, and I had a great 2 years out here. I was independent. I think at 4 years old, I caught the kitchen on fire because I was always into everything, and I was figuring it all out. So by the time I got out of high school, I'd already been like running my own businesses and or business and had money saved up, and I was very independent, you know, and the school thing seemed ridiculous. And there just was a lot of things that I think I look back that I'm happy for, but there was so much stuff as a kid that was really inappropriate. You know, just like they just let us have all the freedom we wanted, and I think that it really was not okay in a lot of ways, and I think it makes a lot of sense as I look back and as I go through my step work and I do the work here of how I got here. So I ended up going back home after being here for a few years and going to college. And that was horrific because I was not good at school. But I was able to somehow lock in and focus just on it because I was a little older and I wasn't so immature. And I did, for some reason, find importance about it because I worked in the real world for a few years and I saw the struggle of finances and how hard it was, especially in Los Angeles, to survive, that I had to figure something else out because it seemed like the world was too hard. So I went to college, I got myself through it, I did study theater, and I would say that it was amazing. And I got to spend time with my mom again, and I got to spend time with my siblings again for the first time in a long time. And then I headed back out to, well, actually then after that I headed to, I don't know, I think as an Al-Anon, I definitely have this dreamer belief system. You know, you could do whatever you wanted. I think I truly believe that to the bottom of my core. So after college, you know, I decided with the church I was involved with, they were doing missionary, they were sending money to El Salvador. I thought to myself, you know, that would be cool. I think I could go down to El Salvador for a while. Well, I was doing a yoga class in college, and this was a long time ago, which was rare, and thinking, I think I should go down there and just hang out, learn Spanish, and check it out, you know? And at the time, El Salvador is very, very dangerous. I mean, it was one of the poorest countries, and it was really, but so, whatever happened, fast forward, I'm sitting in El Salvador, and having this international experience, and learning Spanish, and evolving. So, not all of my experience, I think, growing up with being a dysfunction, you know, dealing with this disease I have and dealing with the disease of alcoholism, and was all bad news. It actually also gave me a lot of experiences and a lot of things I got to do that I wouldn't have done otherwise. And thank God I just never got hurt. Because I think in a lot of times in alcoholism, I think the kids do get hurt. Like, bad things do really happen in alcoholic homes. And I just think that for me, for whatever reason, I didn't. So I was in El Salvador for a while, and that was amazing. I had to have that experience. I did get to learn some Spanish. And I always did have a spiritual background. So, or I always believed in God. I wasn't anti-God or anti-something bigger than me ever. I always was like, yeah, I believe there's something going on. So I got back from that. I did go to California. And then I would say from that time, I spent probably the next 10, at least another 10 to 12 years, basically becoming a very dysfunctional adult. I just couldn't hold a job down. I couldn't have any type of relationship, really. I mean, I had friends, right? And I was great. I was like, hey, what's going on? But I had problems with intimacy. I would probably be in a relationship for like 4 months and then figure out the person was crazy and their mom was crazy, so I can't take, I would just come up with stories, and I was really dysfunctional in all my relationships. So that was work, that was everywhere I went. Now, I did have some friends that I did keep along the way, but I don't know. That year, those 10 years or 12 years were very tough in some ways. And I mean in some ways is because I couldn't feel. So to me, everything was wonderful. I felt like my life was great. You know, I'm out here, I'm living my dream, I'm, you know, doing what I want to do. Everybody else is working their 9-to-5s and whatever. And I was just like floating around, doing side jobs. And I would do geographicals all the time. I had taken off. Like I said, after college, I went to El Salvador for a while. I had gone to the Caribbean and sailed on some guy's ship for a while. I spent time in Thailand. I literally had just, I would just get fed up with life going, I just need a break, man, you know, and I would just take off and go for, I don't know, a few months or whatever. But I still would end up back in California. But I think by the time I got till I was about 36, well, unfortunately, when I was in Thailand teaching English, I felt a culture shock experience, but I feel like I was going through a nervous breakdown or I was in a deep depression, but I wasn't aware of what was going on with me. But during that time, I was like isolated. I was teaching English. I still was having this experience. I was learning a language. I was really growing in some ways. But I was also taking in that culture and learning about how they interact with their families and how, you know, they show respect to. So if we had a break at school, I would say to them, so where are you going to go next week on your break? They're like, well, I have to go home and pay respect to my family. And I go, so what does that look like? And they would say, well, I just have to help my grandparents and see if they need anything. And then I can fix things around the house. And basically they were going home from the city, and they would, like, I guess, just do errands and take care of things that need to be done until the next break. And I was taking this all in, going, well, this is really, I really respect this. I think this is a really wonderful thing that I can see the unity of a family that I think we lacked in the West, that I didn't experience as an alcoholic home at all, basically. So at the time, before I went to Thailand, I was taking care of a woman who had Huntington's chorea, who was very ill, big time meth addict. And I don't know, I would get into these weird situations. All the situations had to do with alcoholics, drug addicts, from the girlfriends to all the jobs, the bosses, whatever. But I had that experience with this woman that I took care of for about a year and a half. And eventually she died from the Huntington's chorea. But the actual purpose, the actual reason of the death was liver failure. So during the time I was taking care of her, as my hustle or my side job, I got to be educated on liver failure and really learn all about how it works and how it swells up and it's got to be drained. I mean, I was her, I took care of her until she died. So I'm sitting in Thailand, 6 months later, and my mom calls and she says she always had liver problems. And I would say, so what? Why would you have liver problems? But also, my mom was also very ill, and she always was, and I was accepted of it. But I think I was numb to it. I don't know if I was accepting of it. I just don't like, she always was in bed. She'd always just say, leave me alone. I just want to die. Get out of my room. Get out of this. You know, just this over-dramatic. Everything was exaggerated. She was super sensitive. She was overreacting on everything, where, you know, she could watch a commercial and just start busting out crying, and you thought that like one of your siblings could have died or something horrific happened. So you know what I mean? We're dealing with these emotions as a kid, even as an adult, where it's like everything's all over the fucking place. You really don't know. You know what I mean? It's like kind of hard to fill out the room or really know, because everything is just so extreme. You know, everything's really bizarre. You know, so she would always say, "I'm gonna die," and all this. So I'm sitting in Thailand, I'm having this experience. I just, my last gig was helping this woman basically all the way to her death with liver failure. And she starts telling me about what was going on. And I go, wow, you're in advanced stages of liver failure. And she goes, yeah, no, I definitely am in advanced stages. This has been going on for a while. And I was like, you know, for some reason I was given the gift to actually hear what was going on or see it. For whatever reason. And So I call my siblings and I go, you know, I think I should leave out of here and head back to her. And she was in Maryland. And maybe I'll just pay my respects, right? Maybe I'll just hang out and do things around the house and just spend some time with her. Maybe she's fine. You know, maybe her liver failure will go for another 2 or 3 years, you know. But I felt that, you know. And then the siblings call me and tell me I'm an asshole. You're ridiculous. You're going all the way from the other side of the world and you're going to come back for her. She's fine. She's been saying this forever. So I get there on a Thursday, I think. She was dead by Monday. And it was the most bizarre thing because the other time that I was with the other woman, her liver failure, it was a struggle for months. It was hell for, I don't know, a year, six. She was in and out of the hospital. It was a long, long time. I think my mom, though, her thing was is that she was struggling for a long time, but I couldn't hear it, and I wasn't living near her, so I didn't really know. And she, they don't tell you. You know, you get to hear everything. But I did get to have that time with her, and it was the most bizarre thing because out of all the kids, I came in from Thailand. They're only 3 or 4 hours away from her. They could have driven down there or whatever. And I got to be with her when she passed. And it wasn't like this horrific thing. Well, the other side of it is I had a lot of experience with death because I was with the other one when she passed. And then my stepdad died also, and he struggled with the disease also. So I had a lot of experience around death. And with hers, it was really peaceful. I got there on a Thursday. We got to hang out on Friday. We went to the dentist. And then Saturday, she like blacked out and wouldn't wake up. And then Sunday, she woke up and hospice was there. They came over and they're looking at me going, are you aware of what's happening? I go, I guess. I mean, yeah, but they're like, well, how long do you think she's going to live? I go, I don't know. You ask her. She goes, I'll live at least a few more weeks. So by Monday, she passed and it was really fast and it was very peaceful. It just was. I don't know how to say it. But at the same time, I didn't know anything about alcoholism when this was happening in front of me. I was totally asleep at the wheel. I had no understanding of my feelings, my emotions. I didn't ever know how I felt ever. But I was there with my mom, and I felt like that was an honor at the time. You know, I was cool. I was like, no, this is great. I got to be here. I was born on her birthday and shit, you know, and this is, and then the siblings came in, you know, in the middle of the night, like 6 hours later through a snowstorm. And that's where all the dynamics coming and people screaming and, it was really hard. That was the hardest part. And what's interesting is that it did take me about a year to figure it out. I definitely hit my bottom that year after she died. It was really painful. It was more painful. I feel like that depression or something when I was in Thailand that I was dealing with was preparing me for that death. So about a year or two after that, I was basically homeless. I went back to California. And I stayed on a guy's couch in his office with no doors to close in the middle of like, an alcoholic family with alcoholism going on, still not aware of what alcoholism was at the time. And I did that for about 2 years, just staying on the couch, because I still was understanding that, you know, I'm living the dream, I don't have a job, I don't have any bills, everything's great. I was just fucking lost. I was totally lost. But that home that I stayed in on the couch for a while, I was trying to reinvent myself. I was trying to figure things out. I think when I saw my mom in the casket, I was looking at her going, you know what? This is going to go fast. Like, this is really going to go fast because she's gone already. And so it did wake me up. It did totally, I started waking up, I think, when that happened. I started becoming not so numb. So fast forward to, you know, having to like reinvent myself and try to find a job or be functional in some way. You know, I just kept fighting. I finally was able to get a job. And I still was living on somebody's couch and I met a girl. And I knew I wanted to meet somebody. I did have intentions and I wanted to get my shit together and I stopped smoking and I knew this was like it. Like I knew this was it. So while I was trying to get work and start a business and do what I wanted to do and find an income and everything, and I met this woman, I had to do whatever I could to make it work. You know, as they say, there's more. I go to a men's stag meeting. We go talk about what. It's more. More guys are coming in here crying over girls, and it's changed their lives than anything they've ever seen. You know, anything. It's so funny. So I did. It was really a girl, and the guy that I was working with at the time, or trying to create an opportunity with, was in AA. And he goes, you know, Matt, if you really like her, well, first he met her, and he goes, no, she's great. He goes, so if you really like her, I think what I recommend you to do, if her drinking's bothering you, you need to go to Al-Anon. So I said, oh. So I started going to Al-Anon, and I realized just by sitting in the back of the room, and I didn't want to see any of you, and I didn't want to be talked to. I was scared. I was weird. I don't know. Whatever you want to talk about it. I just didn't want to be seen in the room. I was able to realize, just listening to you guys, that I've always been around alcoholism. I was getting educated on what it was, what the disease was, how it works, and then starting to see some of my behavior, and that all the girls I've been with were alcoholic. I started for the first time seeing, oh my God, my mom was an alcoholic. And I started plugging things together. And they said, if you come here, you'll see miracles. And if you keep coming, you could possibly see your qualifier, the person that you don't like their drinking, you could see them change. It could affect them. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. So I didn't want to be there, but I was willing to do it for another person, right? Because I was going to change somebody else. And that's what our disease is all about. We love to control others, and we like to tell them what to do and how to do it, because we always know better and how to be done. So I sat in those rooms painfully suffering, and I watched her. Well, we ended up getting married. I was willing to get married because I knew that every girl I was ever with was an alcoholic or an addict. So, and I knew that's just my thing. And I didn't know it was a thing, so I was learning that. So we did get married. So we got married in January. We had lived together for 4 years. So during that 4 years, I started going into the program and going to the things and realized it would be okay. And it gave me the chance to actually realize I could marry an alcoholic. Before the program, I remember breaking up with girls going, she's just drinking too much. Like, oh, well, I'm going to come home and the kids are going to try and kill each other. I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? It's like, so I would leave, you know, leave tons of relationships that way. This one, I was like, no. There's a program. I didn't know about this. And, whoa, this is actually, you know, this is what I like. This is my thing, you know? So we got married. So we got married in January. By May, it'll be 10 years ago now, she would, like, got drunk with the neighbor. She supposedly thought I went to sleep, and then she left the house to go to some other guy's house and all this thing. And then by the time it all worked out, she came back. I just literally blew up and just said, it's not going to work. I did the Al-Anon push, like, this is it. This is real. You better respond, you freaking AA, right? But I didn't know anything that much about telling her to go do treatments or give her orders or marching orders. I was just like, this is marriage is going to work. I'm just giving you a heads up right now. That's kind of was my MO with her. I'm just, for the first time, I had feelings and I was willing to like blare them at her. And so she said, I got this. Don't worry about it. And so she got sober. So I stopped going to Al-Anon once that happened. I just pulled back. I was like, I'm good. She's not drinking. Everything's fine. So I think that went on for probably 2 years. Her life started getting much better. She wasn't drinking. And I don't, you know, I think what happened is that I think one of the most important things about my recovery is that I came into these rooms totally a mess, totally dysfunctional. And I feel like my life didn't really start working until I got with an alcoholic. That relationship forced me to look at myself and become a better person. Because there's no way, there was no intention. It's just the magic of whatever happened. You know, at the end of the day, that's just what happened. So she had challenged me and said, I challenge you to do 12 steps. I know your life would be so amazing if you did 12 steps. So it's so bizarre because I look back, like I was sitting in these rooms for 3 years, miserable, hating life, trying to change her life, and it flipped. She came back to me and said, hey, man, I would love to see what you got. I would love to see what your life would look like with recovery. And so, I don't know why, I guess we're competitive. So within a few weeks, because there was a couple guys I thought about asking to sponsor and everything. So I did, I started it in, that it would be in May of 2017, I started my steps. And there was no looking back. It has transformed me in so many ways. So my life has really, really transformed. The importance of me standing here in front of all you today is really for me not to forget that. I forget, just like Sean was saying yesterday, you got to change it all. He clearly, in this, the same with me. I stopped biting my nails. Everything switched in the, I had to reprogram, get a new perspective, and rethink because my sick disease was not functioning anymore. Those tools that I had as a kid in that alcoholic home were not working in society or anywhere else in my life, anywhere else. And so I had to learn how to do everything differently, and I was willing, and I think that's where the willingness happened. And it came from my wife, who was an alcoholic. She was giving me the willingness, which is so fucking, so priceless, but so bizarre. I never saw it coming. And that's where, once I started doing the 12 steps and I started going through, you know, my fourth step and started doing all the work to really understand what happened and started to uncover the true story and get rigorously honest with who I am. And boy, was it scary. I just don't know why the truth is so hard. It's so hard for me to be honest and look at the fear and look at what happened and realize it all makes sense and there's nothing to worry about. This program is such a gift. I'm just so grateful for Al-Anon. What a big surprise. You know, when I started doing the steps, I was so angry that I wasted that 10 or 15 years. I was so angry. Why couldn't I got here earlier? And I would say about 5 years ago, I found gratitude around it. I was so thankful for all the experiences I had, all the hard times, all the good times, even for the alcoholic home, even for my mom who did the best she could, who had a horrible disease that strangled her and killed her. I'm so lucky to have her. Because it just wasn't her fault, and there was so much confusion, and now the 12 steps gave me clarity. I assume most people die with no clarity of understanding this disease in their own lives and their families' lives. So now I have compassion for my mom who suffered so much. And I truly love the AA. I can't say that that's everybody's recovery. I go to meetings in Al-Anon, and there is a lot of talk and complaining about the disease and the person. And I understand that. But I feel like I have the gift to just have the compassion to understand the disease. so I could actually ultimately have compassion and understand my own disease and start loving myself. That's confusing for me, because I didn't realize I didn't love myself. I didn't realize I was going around life being not enough. I didn't realize, you know, I thought that my education was blamed on the family because I had parents that were sick that couldn't get me the help I needed. But then through the 12 steps, I'm realizing that a learning disability is not something you learn. It's how my brain is made. My dyslexia is something that is something that's how the brain functions. It doesn't matter what house I would have been born in. And I didn't have that clarity. I assumed because I moved around so much as a child and that they didn't get the records to find out what classes I should have been in, that I just was, you know, I would hear this teacher say, he's just stupid, he didn't get performed. What do you want me to do? You know what I mean? I would hear all that stuff. So I came into the rooms and I came in here wanting to change somebody. Ultimately. And that person ended up changing me more than I could ever imagine. And this program of Al-Anon was really all about me. You know, they say it doesn't matter how we get in the rooms as long as we just get in the rooms. You know? And we see in AA, you know, a lot of people go out and there's lots of people relapsing. But the time I've had in Al-Anon, I don't think it's any different. I watch lots of guys with lots of time go away for a while and come back like they basically been using and they're not well. So I think part of my recovery lately or recently is being able to understand that I feel like I even identify with the disease of alcoholism even more, because I feel like if you saw me for those 10 years or 15 years, those 2 years where I was basically living on people's couches, you would have sworn I was using. You would have seen my life was not manageable. My choices were delusional, and that I was not healthy. So I think that once we could put the focus on ourselves, which I didn't realize that's what was going to happen when I started doing step one, that literally they just flipped the thing and said, look in the mirror, pal. Oh, that was so painful. But I was willingness that at that time, it was a perfect time that my higher power came in to say that he's ready now to start looking at himself and see his part in everything. So now I'm in a situation where I'm married. I have a... I have a 4-year-old daughter with this woman. And I was so set not to have a child with an alcoholic. I was so, you know, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to be that stupid. I know better than that. Why put a child like that in harm's way? But the beauty was doing the step work and uncovering, you know, all my stuff and understanding how things got to where they were and be able to stand that it's okay and that things make a lot of sense and that I'm going to be fine and I have the tools of the program to be a functioning person again. My sponsor said, you'd be such a great dad. I just think that you need to rethink this idea of trying not to have a kid with this woman that wants a child. And I just know that this is, you know, it's just, there's overflow everywhere. From the way I deal with my work now, the way that I respond to, it's everywhere. So now it started in the home, it started with the relationship with the wife, and now it's moving into all parts of my life. Now I have relationships with cousins, with people that I could actually call on the phone and feel comfortable to say, hi, my name's Matt, and have confidence and courage, and let them know that I'm okay wherever I'm at, and that today everything's fine, and that I didn't become the actor that I thought I was going to be, and I still love myself. Or even now I actually love myself, you know? So I think that, so now I'm at a point where my wife is, she's not drinking and she's struggling. And it's been years now, ever since the baby came. It's been really, really hard. But I've been able to flourish. I have been able to grow and thrive, even though my wife is in a lot of pain and really getting beaten up right now by her disease. And I'm able to step back and say, I don't know the solution for her. I just need to be a loving husband and be a loving to my daughter. And that's confusing, but in so many ways, I'm not finding my joy by making sure other people are okay. If I'm okay and I'm doing my work and I'm taking care of me, then I could be a better husband, especially if she isn't well right now. And I can be a great dad, even though the child's seeing the mom struggle, and be able to explain things and be able to say, it's going to be okay. And so it forces me to be in my higher power's arms, to have to reach back and know I'm not in control, and find serenity in that, and find peace and clarity on a day-to-day basis, knowing that I'm not in charge. It's liberating. And before, I think that was the confusion. I felt that, you know, you hear people say, you know, God's my co-pilot. And it's like, no, God's not my co-pilot. You know what I mean? I'm sitting in the back and I'm just trusting that God's got it all covered. I can put orders in of places I'd like to go or things I'd like to do, which is being here today with all of you. And maybe it would happen in the right time. And knowing that no matter what happens tomorrow, I just have to be present. Keeping my heart open to everyone. Know that fear will always be a character defect for me. And that's okay, you know, it's okay for me to have just more understanding of who I am. So to all the newcomers that are here today, I hope that no matter what program you're in, that the 12-step program, at least for Al-Anon, for me, has really transformed me into being the best I could be right now in front of you, and has allowed me to be of service to the meetings I go to my wife, to my siblings, to have just so much peace and clarity around the people that are struggling with the disease and the people who have been destroyed by it. And know that miracles are what this program is about. Especially in Al-Anon, we talk about all the tragedy, in Al-Anon, I think I've heard the worst stories of my life in the rooms of Al-Anon. I mean, really, really dark, horrible, the worst things you can imagine. And they get through it, right? People get through it. And people have experience around whatever you're going through. People have been there or have been in it, they know somebody who has. And that's one of the biggest gifts of me of being a sponsor, is that I can say, I don't know, I haven't been through a domestic abuse thing, but Bob has been dealing with that for the last 6 months. Why don't you, you know what I mean? It's like this huge network, this huge, powerful, priceless group of information and help that we have that will change our lives in more ways than our little brain could ever imagine. I just think that there's just so much more that Al-Anon has probably in the future or has for all of us than we could ever imagine. And I think I say that too in all 12 steps. That the 12-step program is a magical thing. It's a principle, it's proven. And it works if you have the willingness. And not everybody has the willingness or it's their time right now. And finding acceptance in that. And that's the same with sponsoring, and that's the same with everybody's recovery, no matter what, that everybody's doing it the best they can when they can. And I think it's just important to talk, to say that, just because acceptance, I think, is one of the biggest things for me in my recovery, next to gratitude. I love you all. I'm really grateful to be here. And that's it. Thank you so much.